This episode of the Fishing Daily Podcast is brought to you by Saltwater Marketing, marketing experts for the commercial fishing and seafood industry in the UK and Ireland. Welcome to the Fishing Daily Podcast with me, Oliver McBride. Today I'm joined by Barry Dees from the NFFO, the National Federation of Fishermen's Organisations in the UK. Welcome, Barry.
Hi there, Oliver. How are you?
Good. Barry, a lot of things happening now in December, and especially the December talks. What's happening there? Have you had any word?
Well, I think there's a lot happening. I think I worked out there's something like five different strands of negotiations underway. We've had the coastal states, of course, that dealt with the big pelagic fisheries in particular. But then we've got trilaterals, UK, Norway, EU, and then we've got bilaterals where Norway and the UK are talking together, EU and the UK are talking, UK and Faroes, and EU and Norway. So all of these strands are running kind of in parallel, and I think the aim is to try and get them across the finish line, hopefully this week, because the TCA specifies for UK and EU that the 10th of December is the deadline to get these things over the line. And I think that's the kind of backstop that people are working to. So there's an awful lot that's going on, and I'm not saying that I'm party to anything like all of it, because you know, what happens in the negotiating room, you know, often stays in the negotiating room until the announcement at the end. So I think we are in the end game. I think there's a lot hanging on this. And I think what will happen is that, you know, in the next few days, and certainly early next week, there'll be a blizzard of information. We'll have the agreed records that will emerge from these talks. And we'll be poring over that with a fine tooth comb to see what the implications are for the industry in the coming year. You know, obviously, organizations like mine have been feeding in really from the summer, as soon as the science comes out. We work on our priorities, what the UK's priorities might be, what the science is saying, and this all comes to fruition now.
You'll be hoping that you'll be able to make a good agreement with Norway and Faroe Islands. There's a lot of last year, a lot of boats seemed to lose out when those agreements weren't in place. How badly were your members affected?
I think there was a really big disappointment last year. Our members were affected. We lost fishing opportunities in the Northeast Arctic and in the North Sea. Access is important to us for those fisheries. I think I discern in the mood music for the negotiations a change of attitude. I think all parties want to reach agreement this year. I think it would be really bad to set a precedent of no agreement. I think the hope is that last year was a bit of an aberration, coming on the back of the trade and cooperation agreement. The UK is an independent coastal state, notwithstanding the provisions of the TCA. And that requires a shift in relationships. And I think last year we can see as a bit of an adjustment period. I think that adjustment will be carrying on. I think this is something that we'll see evolve over time. But what I detect, because we have access to the plenaries remotely on most of these negotiations, and from what our officials are telling us, that there is a dynamism and a will to get agreement this year. What the shape of that agreement is a separate question. You know, the extent and shape of the agreements, well, you know, we'll have to wait a little bit and see. There are some signs that are emerging now, but I think the big picture is that it's highly likely that there will be agreements, certainly with Norway, hopefully with Faroes. And of course, with the TCA, we're kind of obliged to reach an agreement. There's legal obligations there. So there will be an agreement. The content, have to wait and see a bit.
Other areas both that we're talking about a lot as well recently has been the ACES advice and what they're seeing and what fishermen are seeing on the ground. Is your members sort of subscribing to the same thing where, you know, you're worried that maybe the advice is not being accurate enough?
I think what we see in the ICES advice this year is a degree of volatility, meaning that the scientific perceptions have changed quite a lot from last year on an unusual amount of stock. So, you know, for example, North Sea whiting, where you have a 237% increase in the TAC because the scientific perception has changed. That kind of volatility is hard to deal with, especially if it goes the other way. I think that there are always differences in perception between the industry and the science. That doesn't mean that either of them are wrong. They're looking at it from different perspectives. So I wouldn't be amongst those that would criticize the science per se. I think we need the science, and I think above all, ministers and officials will always rely on the science to make their decisions because it covers their back, really. So I think we have to deal with the science. Where there are problems with the models and where there are problems in terms of the data that's going in, I think we have a joint responsibility to fix those. I think the new kid on the block, certainly between the UK and the EU, are non-quota species. You know, these tonnage limits that have been set for non-quota species. And it's really important that we get those right because the data on some of these stocks in particular are very, very thin. And you know, if we were to set catch limits based on the science, we need to make sure that the science is robust. So I think it's a complex picture and it's best not to just reach for the cudgels. It's best to, I think, try and understand what's going on, both in terms of the industry perceptions, but also what's happening within the science.
Closer to home, what impacts has the Trade and Cooperation Agreement had on the UK fleet for you, your members?
Well, we're coming up to 12 months since the TCA was signed, and it was a massive disappointment for the UK fishing industry generally, because expectations had been were raised so high by our own government, and you know what we received was actually relatively marginal changes in terms of. In terms of quota shares, with the possible exception of mackerel. So I think it was a big disappointment. Most coastal states have an exclusive 12-mile limit as a norm. That was one of the UK's red lines, we were told. We didn't get that. So you know, we started the year, I think, very depressed. We always knew that trading into the EU would be more difficult. We would be a third country and we would have to meet higher documentation requirements and costs. No surprise there, but the difficulties that we faced at the start of the year, compounded, of course, by COVID, had a big negative effect. I think from about March onwards, that the trading situation eased, with the exception of the problems with bivalve mollusks, which hit a number of companies very hard. Then the first annual negotiations as an independent coastal state, which of course had spilled over into the year, into 2021. They were very painful, I think, very difficult, because both sides were looking to the future and were very wary of setting precedents. And so I think there were a lot of discussions about principles that I don't detect this year, in this year's negotiations. So so that went on really till mid-year, to July. And in the meantime, quota exchanges were used as a kind of hostage in the negotiations. I think that had a serious negative impact on both sides, because that trade is necessary to maximize fishing opportunities. So I think all in all, it's been a very difficult year. I think the industry has been under a great deal of media attention, one way or another. And you know, the hope is for some kind of stability. The desire within the UK industry, of course, is to be a fully fledged member state. We have that legal, a fully fledged coastal state. We have that legal status, but the reality is that I think we're quite far away from what a normal coastal state would recognize as the benefits that would normally be associated with coastal state status. So I think we'll look back and say it's been a very difficult year, massive disappointment at the beginning, and a struggle through to where we are now.
I think having the first negotiations between the European Union and the UK out of the way now, do you think that this will become easier, that people will be more willing to progress and recognize the independence of the UK to a higher degree and treat them with more respect?
I think there's probably mixed feelings. I think there's a desire to establish some kind of normality, to settle down into a more normal kind of relationship between coastal states with shared stocks. I think that is quite a significant draw. I think we see with the French licensing dispute and some of the comments made around that, I think what you have there is a kind of recognition that the UK may want to do things differently in its waters in the future, and indeed, you know, has ambition to do things differently, particularly through the fisheries management plans that are allowed for in the Fisheries Act. And, you know, this is the way that there will be divergence from the common fisheries policy over time. And I think part of what we see with the licensing dispute is a reluctance to accept that, and a feeling that as the TCA is implemented over time, and as the UK diverges from the common fisheries policy, that things will change. And I think that is part of what we're seeing in certainly some of the statements made by some French fishermen, certainly not all of them. And I think that's part of the political change that we are seeing now, the political and legal change. It's something that will evolve over time. So I think you have these two things in tension. You have, on the one hand, a desire for a kind of normal relationship, settling down, working collaboratively on stocks that we share and we have to fish and manage sustainably. On the other hand, you know, one party wants to move away from the status quo, and the other, in particularly in France, I think was promised or led to believe that what had been achieved in the TCA was the status quo. And it's not. It's something different from that. But that will become apparent over time, I think.
Another area that of corporations will be in the future will be the fisheries committee for in-year quota swaps. How do you feel that's going to work? They're going to have at least or at most four meetings a year, whereas like the fish producers were able to be in contact with each other every day. And no matter where you were in Europe, you could do a trade. That's going to looks like it's going to be an issue somewhere along the line.
Well, I think the Specialized Committee for Fisheries has had a slow start, I think you would say. And you know, one of the reasons there, I think, is that the European Commission hasn't had a mandate to really get down to nitty-gritty type discussions. I don't think that the fact that there's only four meetings a year is particularly significant, because I think underneath that there will be different working groups that will continue the work during the year, and that's actually the engine room. That's where the real nitty-gritty work will take place. And in that sense, I think the specialized committee will meet to ratify what's already been pre-agreed within those working groups. On the exchanges, my understanding is that after a difficult period during the annual negotiations last year, actually earlier this year, the EU and the UK have really settled down into an understanding that these interim arrangements, which allow producer organizations to broker swaps that are then kind of rubber stamped by the member states, that will continue. So I'm hopeful that quota exchanges will not be used as a bargaining chip. I've seen no sign that they've been used as a bargaining chip in this round of negotiations this December in the way that they were earlier in the year. So I think that issue hopefully is now settled down. I hope so.
You were talking earlier about, you know, the disappointment that the UK government didn't stick to the promise of the 12-mile limit. And we've seen a lot of debate and talk about what's happening in the English Channel with fly shooters and other foreign vessels coming in into that space and fishing. It must be very frustrating for your members when they know that the non-quota species is what they're relying on, and this is something that should be protected.
I think this is a really big issue. Because the phrase non-quota species covers so many different stocks. Some of them very high value targeted stocks, scallop, crab, you know, cuttlefish. Others are almost negligible in terms of economic worth. And then we have, you know, in the middle, we've got a kind of large number of demersal species that are in the mix as well. And, you know, the UK industry would look at the trade and cooperation agreement and say, well, the EU are allowed to fish 40,000 tons of non-quota species in UK waters. UK vessels are allowed to fish 12,000 tons in EU waters. The lack of symmetry in the common fisheries policy has been transferred really into that relationship. But that's where we are at least for the next 6 years. Well, 5 years, 2026. So what do we do about that? I think the UK's aspiration is to move towards some kind of rational management system based on science, because what you have now is fairly arbitrary figures based on retrospective reference period. 2012 to 2016, And I think that causes problems both for the UK, but possibly more significantly for the EU. And then in that mix is the crown dependency dimension as well, where I think there's about 10,000 tons that you take out of that and fit into the crown dependency, who have autonomy over the way they manage their fisheries. So it's a complex area. And I mentioned earlier that, a lot of these stocks are data poor. How do we get to a situation where you can have rational, evidence-based fisheries management in these? And it's not something that you can just flick a switch and it'll happen. Something that's going to have to be worked at. I think one of the difficulties is that, you have these limits that are in the TCA, and then you have the biological realities that are out there, all these different species. Some of them will have good conservation status, some of them will be weaker. How do we manage that in a rational way? I think maybe we have to focus on indicator species, managing 200 species in a block doesn't make an awful lot of sense, but 200 species is an awful lot to build a science on all and management measures all at one go. But perhaps the solution lies in using indicator species that are used to measure the health or otherwise of particular groups of species. That might be a way forward. That's for discussion. So I think, in terms of England and Wales, non-quota species carry a higher landings value than quota species, actually. So this is enormously significant for the future of the industry, and it's something that is going to be a priority for the future for all sides, I think.
We've seen a lot of these NGOs and documentaries and all the sensationalism about the fishing industry and how it's destroying stuff. But what you were talking about there is a lot of, the science has to go back in, and the fishing industry can put that science back in again. Do you think that there needs to be something done by either the industry itself or by the government in order to re-educate people about the fishing industry and the fact that it is working towards improving things?
Well, on the big picture, there has been enormous improvement. If you are describing the 1990s, the 80s and into 90s, it would be fair to say that things were in decline, that stocks were overfished, that the management system wasn't working, that there was overcapacity. I think if you look at this, the ICES statistics, the ICES figures, there was a turning point around about the year 2000, and fishing mortality came down dramatically. There was big decommissioning schemes around about that period that kind of right-sized the fleets, if you want to look at it that way. And from that point onwards, you saw stocks coming up, some very dramatically, like hake and like North Sea Plaice. And sure, there will be environmental conditions that play into that as well. And there are outliers. Bass took a dive, and cod, North Sea. Cod faces particular environmental challenging conditions because of sea temperature changes. But I think that the big picture is one of improvement. And yet, as you say, there's a lucrative industry out there denigrating the fishing industry and painting this catastrophe narrative that really plays very well in parts of the media, and it gets picked up. But it's contrary to the truth. And so I completely agree that we need to improve our work in this area and to ensure that the media understands that there is another side to the story, that what we have is an industry that plays a really important part in food security, that certainly faces challenges. Every fishing method has an environmental footprint. and our responsibility is to manage that footprint. To make the case that fishing is per se a destructive, a negative force is really to kind of miss the point. There are good people in the United States associated with Washington University that do their very best to counter that kind of mist of fog of propaganda that comes down, and to challenge the assertions that are made on with no basis whatsoever. I think we need something similar in the UK, and actually there are talks going on at the moment between fishing organisations about what that might look like and how it might be funded. So I think I can't say it's at an early stage. I can't say much more than that. But I think it's a job of work for us to do there.
That would be very interesting to see what they can come up with. All right. There's also the question as well. 2026, we'll see the terms of the trade and cooperation agreement being renegotiated. What do you think between now and that time that the UK government can be doing in order to improve the lot for the fishermen?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Fisheries Act, which gives the UK ministers powers to manage, to set quotas and manage our own fisheries. I think that's a really important piece of legislation. And it was a bit of a fight coming through Parliament, but I think that the end result was actually quite good. I think that these fisheries management plans, which instead of being kind of broad brush, sea basin level or CFP level, I think the ability to develop management plans that fit with each individual fishery. Now that might be a species, or it might be a group of species. Some of them will have international dimensions. So it's very much horses for courses. And I don't underestimate the job of work that's involved. Some of them in relation to shellfish are progressing quite well, and we'll see in the early new year. I think there'll be associated with the joint fishery statement, there'll be a list of management plans that will be the first ones out of the blocks. So I think domestically, how we manage fisheries in UK waters will evolve and improve over time, because we have the tools to do it, and we're not tied into the common fisheries policy, where decisions were made very, very remote from the people that are affected by them. In that process, we would hope that there will be an opportunity for the industry at the grassroots to have a say and to shape those management plans. So, that's what the job of work to do domestically. That, of course, takes place within the TCA until 2026. And what happens after that, I don't have the answer. Some days I'm more optimistic than others. I think the EU believes that it has strong dissuasive powers that would make the price of moving away from the TCA in terms of access and quota shares would be made so high that the UK government would balk at it. On the other hand, a lot hinges on the complexion of the government that's in place in the UK at the time, and what is happening in the world at the time. So like I say, I have pessimistic days, I have optimistic days. I think we will work, with the government to see what the options are at the time. It seems like a long time away in some ways, but I think it will be on us very quickly. There is a big responsibility on us to prepare.
Aside from the current talks that's going on at the moment, what is the future for the NFFO? What's going to be happening? Is there anything big coming up in 2022?
Well, we've been working, of course, within the context of COVID, which has prevented us from meeting in our, you know, our executive committee would meet every, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, something like that in normal times. And I think we miss that because there's a lot of interaction on the margins. You know, people talk to each other, understand each other's perspectives, the different fisheries, because, you know, the one thing that we are is diverse. We have a hugely diverse membership, and understanding the different perspectives, different fleet segments is really important. And I think we've missed that. On the other hand, I think we've lent ourselves quite well to the new medium. The, using Zoom and Teams has allowed us to function quite well. We have numerous meetings, weekly with different branches of government. I think that the challenges we face, in addition to the ones that you've mentioned about adapting to, the TCA and what might follow that, the spatial squeeze, you know, the expansion of offshore wind and what happens in terms of marine protected areas and the potential for displacement, I think is one of the really big issues that we confront as an issue. A tenfold expansion of offshore wind carries huge implications. And if marine protected areas, which cover 38% of English waters, if that is applied in ways that displace fishing vessels, I think we face a very, very difficult future. I think we have managed to make the government understand what's at stake. All these management plans that I've been talking about are thrown into disarray if you change fishing patterns, because the science is based on looking back and then projecting forward. And if in the meantime, everybody's fishing in different places, you can throw that out of the window. So it's got huge implications for where people fish, what they fish for, who they're fishing beside. You can have these unintended consequences, knock-on effects. So I think for the NFFO, one of the really big strands that we'll be focusing on will be the displacement, how to mitigate displacement, how to minimize it, and, where necessary to adapt to it.
Thank you very much for joining us today. And hopefully you'll join us soon again and we'll get an update on what's happening and how you felt the December dialogue went.
Thank you really for this opportunity. I think it's really good that the industry and the wider general public have access to this kind of information. It really helps. Like I said, I think we've adapted quite well to working remotely. It does have its drawbacks, but one of the improvements that we've seen is just the accessibility. I mean, for to hold an executive committee in the NFFO, you've got people traveling from Northumbria, Cornwall, Wales, the southeast, East Anglia. There's a lot of travel. I can tell you our travel costs have gone down a lot because of, we made big savings because of COVID. But on the other hand, so it does work in working remotely, but you do lose something as well. So I think what the coming year and years will be about is getting the balance right. Having been able to meet face to face and continue, but perhaps not as frequently, maybe in a different kind of format, because I think that the face to face meetings are important as well. But the density of our work, I think, actually increases. Instead of having to spend half your day traveling to a meeting, you're kind of getting on with it. So. It'll be a hybrid future, but where the balance lies, we'll have to wait and see.
Thank you for joining us today, Barry.
Very happy. Thank you very much.
Thank you.